what is lovely about this country? I asked, my husband said, it's the air. The air is so transparent that you could see what happened 3,000 years ago. And if we shan't get Palestine as a Jewish state, it will be nobody's fault but our own.
Oh, he was a fine man. My goodness, he was a fine man. One of the finest men I've ever known. The charm of his personality is so difficult to convey because it was the sparkle in his eyes that fetched me. I thought this is Isaiah with a sense of fun.
The Lord shall set his hand again the second time to recover the remnants of his people. And he shall set up an ensign for the nations, and shall assemble the outcasts of Israel, and gather them together from the four corners of the earth.
On May the 18th, 1948, Chaim Weizmann, then in the 75th year of his life, was elected president of the State Council of Israel. No wonder that in giving thanks to the providence of history, his voice was dissolved in tears.
Baruch ata Adonai, Eloheinu melech haolam, shehegyanu, v'kimanu, v'hegyanu, lazman hazeh. Amen.
He had led Israel for 40 years across a wilderness of martyrdom and anguish, of savage oppression and frustrated hope, across the sharpest agony which ever beset the life of any people, and towards the end of his days, he entered on his due inheritance of honor, the embodiment in modern times of that kingly and prophetic tradition which once flourished in Israel.
When our Declaration of Independence was issued, some of us in Israel did not know whether we were signing the birth certificate or the death warrant of the Jewish state. The Proclamation of Independence was in itself a great act of courage.
Israel under fire. The first broadcast recorded from Palestine since the end of the British Mandate. The first broadcast from Tel Aviv in the new Jewish state of Israel.
Israel was no sooner born than her very survival was imperiled. High opportunity and deadly danger came together in that moment, side by side. A young reporter was there representing a Boston newspaper. Within a dozen years, he was to be Attorney General of the United States and Senator from New York, Robert Kennedy.
I was struck by the fact that the armies of Israel were greatly outnumbered by the armies of the Arab countries, and that if you just lined it up one against one, Israel was going to be beaten. I came back of the strong opinion that Israel was going to win, that this was their one chance of building a life for the future. They were going to fight with their bare hands. They would all be wiped out before they would give it up, and they were going to either accomplish it or they were going to die doing it.
Dewey Stone recalls how Weizmann spoke to him in the crucial days.
I shall never forget one time when he said to me, knowing the terrific odds, he doubts whether he would have had the courage to have ordered thousands of Jewish boys and girls into battle, knowing that many of them would never return.
The Jews of Israel did the impossible. They fought tanks with rifles. They fought bombers with machine guns. And when there were no heavy guns, many of them became the human carriers of the charges that had to blast the enemy from his position.
It's the same kind of spirit that is won wars against overwhelming odds all throughout history, whether it goes back to the Greeks, where one of the Greeks once said that if you knew what liberty was, freedom was, that you'd fight for it with your bare hand. What motivated the United States during the Revolutionary War? And in my judgment, it was the same spirit that has come down through history which motivated the Jews in Israel. This was why I felt the wave of history and the cause of history was on their side.
The signing of the Egyptian-Israeli General Armistice Agreement is a momentous event in the history of Palestine and in the relations between Israel and the Arab states.
For his part in helping Israel and Egypt reach their armistice agreement, Ralph Bunche, the United Nations mediator, was to win the Nobel Prize for Peace. With this agreement signed, Israel turned from the battlefield to the tasks of peace, but she would never forget the unequal struggle.
David went up to meet Goliath, and the world stood by skeptically. And now that David has defeated the giant, our greatest concern is the building up of a permanent peace.
Sir Winston, do you see any prospects for Arab-Israel peace?
I think it's a most wonderful thing that this community should have established itself so effectively, turning the desert into fertile gardens and thriving townships, and should have afforded a refuge to the millions of their co-religionists who had suffered so fearfully under the Hitler, and not only under the Hitler persecution. I think it's a wonderful thing. I'm a Zionist. Let me make that clear. I was one of the original ones after the Balfour Declaration, and I have worked faithfully for it.
The Balfour Declaration. This had been Weizmann's most decisive achievement. He had been a young lecturer in chemistry at Manchester University when the First World War broke out. But in England in 1914, he had sensed a promise in the air of new and wonderful opportunities to be snatched from the changing interests and fortunes of the powers. Israel Zeef had stood by Weizmann's side in those lonely days.
I can remember his shining eyes at the mass meeting in the London Opera House, which was held to celebrate the Balfour Declaration. He told me that for the first time he felt that in Jewish history, since our exile, the Jews were being given a position of equality amongst the free nations of the world.
Our people were to find a home, not a refuge, not an asylum, not a mere shelter, but a home with which their past memory and future hope were inseparably bound up.
Looking at the platform from which Balfour and other statesmen spoke their congratulations, Dr. Weizmann saw the first battle won, and already he was visioning the next stage of the Jewish road to an independent state.
Over the busy scene of Jewish national revival, there lurked the oncoming shadow of disaster. Weizmann had spoken to a royal commission in 1936 of a dread fate awaiting 6 million Jews. His prophetic intuition was soon to be tragically fulfilled. Eliyahu Eilat, president of the Hebrew University of Jerusalem and a trusted follower of Weizmann, reads an extract from his diary in 1937.
One morning, I visited Dr. Weizmann at his hotel in Paris. I found him in what was for him an unusual state of mind, nervous, wrapped in his thoughts, and reluctant to talk. All of a sudden, he turned to me and said, "You've probably noticed that I am not myself this morning, and I want you to know the reason. Last night, I had a terrible dream. A dream so terrible that it has shaken me completely, and I can't get over the experience. I saw myself in the city of Warsaw, and it was the night of Kolny Drei. I saw myself entering the great synagogue, and when I entered, I saw a multitude of Jews filling the huge hall. When they saw me, they withdrew and divided into two groups, and I saw myself walking down the empty aisle to the holy ark. I approached the ark and lifted the curtain, and suddenly the whole congregation of thousands burst out crying. I have never in my life heard nor felt such bitter and desolate weeping. I was so shaken that I awoke and realized it was a dream." "But," continued Dr. Weizmann, "I tell you, Eliyahu, this dream was meant to tell me that something terrible awaits the Jews of Europe."
Grüßen wir Berliner Nationalsozialisten, Sie, mein Führer!
At the height of the Second World War, Weizmann was plunged in cosmic gloom. He had received authentic and horrifying news of the Jewish tragedy in Europe, where his people were being slaughtered by millions. His son had been killed in air combat against the Nazis. It was in this dark mood that Adlai Stevenson found him in London.
"Not so long ago, I chanced to hear a group of spirited young people singing the songs of many lands. One song in particular stayed with me long after the singing, for who could ever forget the poignant melody of Am Yisrael Hai, the people of Israel live. And as I thought about that tune and about those words, I could not help but remember that day many years ago in January of 1940, when I first saw and met Dr. Chaim Weizmann, and heard him speak those very same words. The people of Israel do live. The nation of Israel will live. The war in Europe had just begun, and Dr. Weizmann had come to the United States to tell again the story of the urgent need for a Jewish homeland. He did not fail to impress each one of us with his tolerance and compassion, with the humble, earthy good humor of many great men. He did not complain of his adversaries, nor did he speak of them with bitterness or hate. He simply related the facts of the struggle his cause was facing and asked not for sympathy, but for understanding.
The National Home as it stands today, even in its limited form, battling against great difficulty, is a living organism. A living organism is never finished. It only finishes when it dies.
Here, I thought, is no conqueror. Here is a creator. Here is the imperishable quality of great historical leadership. And as I sat listening to him recount exciting fragments from the past and dream vividly of the future of Zion, I was struck by his quiet determination, by his resolute will, and by his charity, forbearance, and good humor. He talked of how applied science could help new settlers in a new homeland, but he also talked of the spirit that would unite the ingathered outcasts of the world, the spirit of freedom, of intellectual liberty.
The smallness of the Jewish state in Palestine will be no bar to its full intellectual achievement. Athens was only one small city, and the whole world is still its debtor.
Not by might, not by power, but by my spirit, saith the Lord. For to Dr. Weizmann, the spiritual rebirth of Judaism in its homeland was as important as the physical rescue of the victims of the Nazi Holocaust. Am Yisrael Hai, the people of Israel would live, as they had managed to live for over 2,000 years of troubled wandering, by their faith as well as by their resourcefulness.
Mein Kind hat mir gesagt, ich stehe in die Kinschuhe im Ghetto. Sagt sie mir, Mami, ich hab's noch mal angetan, ich habe jetzt die Sachen mit Füchtern und Schießen.
While we were lined up in the ghetto, my child said, Mother, why did you make me wear the Shabbat dress? We are being taken to be shot.
Schrien zum Taten, sie da, Mami, was mit mir gelassen leben, was bei ihr die Sündige.
Sagt ihr, Lavi.
I cried out, Mother, Father, did I sin so heavily to deserve this torture?
In 1945, the curtain went up on a continent of Europe drenched with Jewish blood. Would the most tormented of peoples be the only people to be denied the shelter and consolation of nationhood? It seemed seriously probable that this would be so. On the morrow of Allied victory, Weizmann claimed Jewish statehood at the bar of the world's conscience.
Times have changed. New situations, new conflicts have arisen. And new conditions must now be sought to enable us to fulfill our unique destiny as a nation in Palestine. The main justification, the main necessity for a Jewish state arises from the fact and urgency of life itself.
Weizmann believed that the state must be created first and proclaimed and recognized thereafter. It is in that spirit that David Ben-Gurion reappraises Weizmann's achievement.
Weizmann was not the first of the great galaxy of the Jewish leaders in our generation. Yet no other Zionist leader understood and supported the great struggle of the Chalutzim to the extent that Chaim Weizmann did. No Zionist leader outside the camp of the Chalutzim so appreciated the significance of the efforts of these pioneers. It was his warm sympathy for pioneerdom, which was deep and great in his soul, that constituted Weizmann's unique synthesis of Jewish leadership.
Weizmann's victories were the victories of personality. They were won very largely by his presence and bearing, by the intense variety of his cultural experience, by a unique blend of Western sophistication and East European Jewish warmth. Abraham Feinberg, a partner in many of Weizmann's political and scientific aspirations, conveys something of Weizmann's personal magnetism.
I don't think I shall ever forget the picture of him coming down the main staircase of the hotel, flanked by his aide on one side and his wife on the other, helping him because of his poor eyesight. And when he came close enough to see me, which was quite close, he put out his hand and said, "Boss." He called me boss, and I called him chief. "We must get together," with a British overtone in his accent. "We must get together for a bit of a schmooze." It struck me then that my impression of the East and the West and the blending of these two cultures was no more adequately or succinctly proven than this one phrase. Of course, we all saw him off with sadness in our hearts because he looked then like a defeated lion going back to his lair.
Another captive of Weizmann's scientific vision was Harry Levine, treasurer of the Weizmann Institute of Science.
No, I don't think he was a very happy man. He seemed to carry the burden of the whole world on his shoulders. He was so concerned about everything that was going on in any part of the world, especially where it affected our Jewish people, and was disturbed terribly by the thought that in a world that has so much, there are many, many people who are suffering all kinds of agonies. On many occasions, tears used to roll down his cheeks, and it hurt me to think that in spite of his great accomplishments, he did not appear to be a very happy individual. It was very heartbreaking to see this great leader of mine actually crying like a little child.
Dewey Stone, chairman of the Board of Governors of the Weizmann Institute of Science, recounts another episode of Weizmann's humane temper.
We were in his bedroom. He was in bed, propped up. He just felt that he was saying goodbye. Present at the same time was his son and another friend. He wanted all of us to have one of his personal possessions, which he was fond of. All of us instinctively felt that his son Benji should be the first one to make the choice. But Benji himself, with Mrs. Weizmann's approval, insisted that I should make the first choice, as a result of which I am to this day the proud possessor of Weizmann's studs and cufflinks. I shall never forget Benji saying at the time that I am sure that in many ways you are more a son to Weizmann than I am. I can only tell you that I always felt that he was like a second father. ¶¶